Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Lead this next part of the discussion, and then we are going to have the ASA Cupped members who are going to tell their story, and then, of course, we're going to have a little music. So with that, I introduce Dennis McNally.
Thank you, sir. Hi, welcome to watching a dream be achieved. In front of your eyes, for the next couple, 3 hours, you are going to watch something that is going to have these people be overnight successes after 50 years. It's about time. We're going to start off with, because this is, after all, in addition to being a regular old party and record release, it's also the Commonwealth Club, and we have to have some smidges of sobriety. And stuff. So I want to introduce to you two people that are going to join me in giving you a wee introduction to where Ace of Cups came from, you know, because nobody comes out of nowhere. On my right is Nick Merriweather, who is a scholar of this era. He's the founding curator of the Grateful Dead Archives at UC Santa Cruz. He's editor of a bunch of books of scholarly essays about the dead and other various aspects of the San Francisco music scene. You know, something really special. Well, I'll start that with him. And I might add that he had a lot to do with helping Joel Selvin's book, Summer of Love, and my own A Long Strange Trip. So thank you for that. Okay. And they are going to be handed mics, yes. Or they're going to steal them. On my left, one of the other reasons, along with the Ace of Cups, that you're here, which is George Wallace, president of High Moon Records. Without...
Not president, really, but better. Yeah. I like you, president. President.
Fearless leader, how about? Without, all kidding aside, without his support, we would not be here. There would not be this amazing record. And you would not be able to see and hear what has to be one of the most remarkable debut albums of all time. I mean, it's just as simple as that. I want to mention two other names before we get started, and that is Alec Palau is an extraordinary music archivist who put together, you saw in the course of that, It's Good For You, It's Bad For You, It's Bad For You, But Buy It Anyway, which was a collection of rehearsal, not studio stuff, but snippets of live Ace of Cups that he put together with, you know, certainly with their cooperation. And that is... And George will tell the story, but that is what sort of, among other things, led George to this story. He's in Europe, Alec's in Europe, so send out a little hi, Alec, because he also, without him, you know, he's an essential element. And one other name that's very important, and again, you saw him in the video, Dan Shea, the producer, who, you know, and his partner, Rita, are you out there somewhere? Rita, take a bow for Dan, would you? Because, again, he has a lot. Sometimes when you gather up folks that sort of coming back, or in this case, starting after a long time in terms of recording, the idea is that, you know, you play some blues and you do it quick, and that's not what George intended, that's not what Dan intended, and that's why this sounds as contemporary and as amazing as it does. So, before we get to George, I'm going to start with Nick. And that's the background of all of this good stuff. And I'll make the remark that the name of the event is Course Correcting Rock History. And as a rock historian, you get to participate in this. Why is this story important about rock music history? And why are you here?
I'm sure we're all wondering that. But thanks very much for a kind introduction, Dennis. Thank you all for being here. Thanks especially to the Ace of Cups for making all of this possible. George, for making all of this possible. Just a real honor. When Dennis and Rachel Ann told me I was supposed to be helping to provide some context, my first reaction was sheer unalloyed horror. How can I actually, someone who was born in 1964, sit up on a stage and start providing context to people who actually are the context? And then they also told me that I only had 5 minutes. So my response to that was to think about it and say, you know, the interesting thing is the Ace of Cups has actually run throughout all of my interest in the 1960s. And I think that's true of not only my generation, my cohort, but young people, even younger people today. So I got to say that I was most first interested in doing this because I remember when I first found the 2003 Big Beat compilation that Dennis mentioned by Alec Palau, I think I turned on more friends, made more people happy by passing out copies of that CD than any other slice of the San Francisco Underground. It's a luminous CD in a lot of ways, and I was so glad to hear that it would finally actually have a studio rendition. What the CD taught me, though, and everyone that I turned on with it, was that it proved that some of the best music of the Hate and of the era was really not well known. And some of it had barely survived, in fact. And the story of that CD really kind of haunted me ever since then. How could something this good have almost vanished? And history is full of stories like that. But the Hate seems especially prone to what one scholar called the mists of mismemory. And unfortunately, we've got historians like Dennis who helped set the stage for all of that and serve as an admirable corrective. I would be remiss if I didn't say here as a quick aside, Dennis's history, Long Strange Trip, is about a lot more than the Grateful Dead. You can't tell the story of a band like the Grateful Dead without discussing the broader Haight-Ashbury. So for all of you who haven't read that, shameless plug time, if you wish to know more about the context that really explains the formation and the genesis of the Ace of Cups, a great starting spot is Dennis's A Long Strange Trip.
I'll give you the money later.
Dennis's work has also led to some other fine amateur historians, and I'd be remiss here if I didn't mention Corey Arnold, whose Rock Prosopography 101. Go Googling for it, and you will find Corey systematically worked with band members to compile an exhaustive list of all known Ace of Cups performances in the 1960s all the way through the early 70s. So an amazing job that he did as well. And it's a huge boon for fans today because it was a heck of a lot tougher to track down details like that when I was first working on the music of the Hate and the Hate in general in the 1980s. And Corey is the one who made the really astute observation that throughout the 20th century, the Ace of Cups band was a mystery bordering on myth. And that was certainly my experience. I first discovered the Ace of Cups through the posters. And the amazing thing is, if you're a poster aficionado, it's funny how often the Ace of Cups seems to be a major part of that amazing poster art. And that's another key to why the Ace of Cups matter so much and still matter so much today, because the career really does span the history of the Hate. In many ways, you could say they embody the story of the Hate, from the promise and the hype of 1967 to the turbulence and turmoil of 1968, and to the diaspora and diffusion of 1969. And the Cups were there through all of it. They played with everybody, it seems, as you can tell by looking at the posters. And they earned their fair share of praise, not only from critics like Ralph J. Gleason, but also from fellow musicians like Jimi Hendrix. And for good reason, too. They are wonderful songwriters and musicians, enormous range and expression. Irony and satire, poetry and power, anguish and anger, all wrapped in haunting harmonies. Music and gospel song, I think, are magnificent and memorable Haight-Ashbury anthems, and I think they're also very gifted interpreters. Y'all's version of Afro Blue still remains to this day my all-time favorite rendition of that jazz standard and classic. And it isn't dated, and that's why we're here tonight, because the Cups music is still timely, still relevant, and their new material is just as magnificent and memorable. And a final quick nod to our friend Alec, who can't be with us and really should be on this stage. In his liner notes for the Big Beat compilation, Alec called it, quote, necessarily flawed collection because the Ace of Cups were never given the opportunity to express themselves in a proper studio environment. And thanks to George and to High Moon Records, now at last that has happened. Thank you, George.
Thank you, Nick. All right, let's terrorize George now.
I couldn't have done it without the Ace, I'm telling you guys. Well, I mean, you think it was easy? No. It's these guys. They make it look easy. I don't know what I'm saying. Dennis, go ahead.
Well, just why don't you just tell us how you found the Ace?
As a 15-year-old East Coast boarding school burgeoning deadhead in the 80s, which were just the best days. Some say everyone's youth is the best days, right? Except anyone born after like 98 or any millennial and beyond. It's so boring. No underground anymore. Seriously. But in the 80s, there was still an underground, and the Dead were the least popular thing, you know, in 1985. Barely got any coverage, whatever. Big fan of them in boarding school and, you know, looking at pictures and books about the 60s, I see the Ace of Cups on all the posters, as Nick was saying. I was like, somehow the band names are all pretty damn strange. I mean, Quicksilver Messenger Service, Frumious Bandersnatch, Big Brother and the Holding Company. I don't know why the Ace of Cups did not seem like a band to me. I'm like, what the heck is the Ace of Cups? Like, of all the names, the Ace of Cups, Country Joe and the Ace of Cups, I thought they were a catering outfit. I was like, because like Ace of Cups, in my mind, like, oh, like Whiz of light shows. I don't know. These, in my mind, they were like, maybe they did catering and, you know. Anyway, so that literally, what is that, 33 years ago, I saw them on a number of posters, and there was no internet back then, but you read books and whatever. So I thought, my first thought was they must have catered at a lot of these, because, I don't know, Ace of Cups. Vivid imagination. I, too, was experimenting with some alternative substances.
You didn't know, did you?
I didn't know.
What?
Anything what
keep
you're
going.
Saying.
No, you didn't know you were caterers. Well, you were caterers of another kind, of a you know, inspirational and musical and poetic kind. Anyway, so fast forward to really, honestly, I have to, Alec Palau is, you know, the man in terms of bringing bands such as the Ace of Cups, course correcting rock history, right? And you know, so as any fan after moving on to other bands of the 60s, and then you hear every band you've ever heard of, and you get really bored after hearing the same song. There must be something else out there, and you start looking at reissue labels and stuff like Big Beat and Al Cloud puts on. I got the Ace of Cups. I was like, what? They're not caterers? I remember seeing the CD. I was like, that's who the Ace of Cups were? They're an all women's band from the Hate back then? You know, it was 2004. I was like 34. And it blew me away, you know? Definitely for caterers, these chicks play. I mean, for caterers? Holy guacamole, these girls are good. But no, I mean, and his liner notes are brilliant, and the music was like, I'd heard, you know, most of all the mainstream bands and some of the, and that, there was, so, you know, it blew me away, that CD. So I would have to say, if anyone really course-corrected rock history and is, you know, he did not bring them to the, you know, full fruition of a studio album, but without that CD out, really, true, you know, these guys, you know, they'd be doing their thing and still having amazing times. But really, Alec is the guy that brought it to public attention.
So fast forward to Mr. Gravy's
birthday party.
75th?
His 75th birthday
party. 75th birthday party, in which the Ace of Cups were reunited to play. And so you saw them live for the first time, or in the rehearsals.
Yeah, I'd seen them. Yeah, and so
and somewhere in there, you got an idea.
I got an idea. Wavy and I could take off, head out west, do some little truck stop gigs. He could do some play his Akhtar. I could do some crazy freeform poetry, and maybe something could happen. Then I was like, wait, oh, no, no, no. That's a silly idea. I mean, Wavy probably wouldn't want to leave Jahanara. I'd be good at the freeform poetry, but alone in truck stops in the Midwest, probably wouldn't get too far. So I had
Instead, I had
you know, spoken with the Ace and Denise, and we thought we were just going to try to find some more archival material, which there was some, but there just wasn't enough. And then you guys from that event, I don't think you'd all played together in about 8 or 10 years. They started to sort of rehearse and get together more frequently than they had in the past 10 years, and we were talking, and then all of a sudden, I don't remember the moment, but all of a sudden we just, it wasn't my idea, but it was our idea, like, let's...
Wavy's birthday, that's what brought us
I mean, Wavy's birthday, right, so there's Alec Palau, there's the Ace themselves, and their parents, and grandparents, and every, back to the apes that were the ancestral apes of the Ace. Then there's Alec Palau, then there's Wavy Gravy, and then there's me and them, and then, yeah, we started, let's do an album, why not? I mean, what could be a more interesting, I'd like to know if anyone in the audience could think of a more, you're hanging out with these guys, hearing them play, you've heard their older music made pretty much like before you were born and possibly up to your conception, or not that my parents were listening, they were in New York and they weren't, you know, into that, it was more opera and Cole Porter for my parents, but you know, what is a more cool? I mean, I feel like I was given a gift. I mean, what could be a more cool project than to make a record of with the Ace of Cups? For goodness sakes!
True enough. Do we see Jasper?
Yeah.
Is Jasper invisible?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, good. Thank you. Right. Thank you for that.
Do I have like one more minute?
You have one more minute.
Okay.
You're on the clock.
Once Ace of Cups released their first CD in 2003, and then when Kelly put out her piece, to me it was like they emerged from Brigadoon, mists of time, but mini Beatlemania occurred, and people started pouring into the website that Mike, Diane's partner, made. And then, so I was reading on the plane coming here last night from New York some of the comments, and I'll just read like two or three. This is from 2003 when the CD came out till about a year and a half ago. Okay, so someone wrote in 2003, after all these years, it's very wonderful to hear that your music can be heard again. Rarely has music, after all, it was only one short set from October 1969, had such a hold on me and stirred my soul and heart. Music, everything will be all right. Yes, indeed. John Addy. And then I'll read like three more. This guy heard them on Volunteers. He looked them up. He said, man, I first heard you with Quicksilver, then I started following you wherever you were playing. I even followed you to small venues. Like, remember the gig at St. Elizabeth's High School in Oakland? I love the harmonies, and especially the fact that you were a female band. You were first, before the Go-Go's. You were, to me, a breath of fresh air in the music business. He goes, sorry I never spoke to you. I was an extraordinarily shy young guy. Yes, I'm buying the CD. This is the 2003 one. And sending the website out to friends who may or may not remember the good old days. Take care. I'll read two more. One more? Thank you. One's from Poland. If someone writes in, I'm at 60. You'd be like, okay, I'm not reading that one. I'm reading two more. I'm 17, and I've recently discovered your record. I absolutely love it. I've always loved music from the late 60s, but you guys your guys' record, this 2003, live and all, is total perfection. The blend of garage rock and wistful gospel-esque jams is incredible. It's also rad that y'all are an all-girl band, breaking all the rules back then. Keep rocking. I could blast your music any day, every day. And one last one.
Really and truly.
Okay, there's two last ones. This guy. Okay. One last guy was in the Navy. Where the hell is this guy? He's like, I only saw your group once. It had to be 67 or January 68 because I was in the Navy then. I got transferred from the Bay Area in early 68. This is almost done. I'm pretty sure it was the Avalon because I only went to concerts there at the Winterland. And I know it was not Winterland. I do remember who else was playing Do Not that night, which is ironic because I'd never heard of you guys before. But your set made a tremendous impression on me. Before I left the area, I managed to track down your manager and beg to buy a copy of the concert because on supposedly good information, the entire night was recorded. He was very friendly, laughed, and then said I should buy the album. I never realized I'd have to wait 40 years. And that was for the 2013. Right. Lots more of this came from doing an all-night seminar of the 10,000 quotes of the ace.
Hold on to it. George and Nick and I are going to disappear, and Jasper Fellen, who I will introduce in 10 seconds, and the Aces will tell their own story. It is fair to say that the Ace of Cups rather think of Jasper as their nephew in common. His parents, Ron and Marcia Fellen, Ron was co-founder of the Psychedelic Shop, and an eminence of Haight Street in the day. And Marcia, who is here tonight? Yes, please stand up and wave. And Kira, Jasper's mother and sister. Ron and Marcia decided that Haight Street was getting crazy even earlier than some, and escaped to Fairfax. And her home, their home, the Red House, became a legendary gathering place for the Ace, for the Diggers, for a lot of people. And Jasper embodies all that, and that's why he's going to come up here. So, Jasper Fellen. Let's give him some room. Hi, it's been a long time. I haven't seen you.
Good stuff. All right, thank you so much.
Thank you, man.
I need to hold this script because as the... in the midst of this week, you know, a few things that the Ace were planning getting used to. I'm going to squeeze that up. They also had the time to write an interactive script. They fit that in their free time this week. And so we're going to go through it. And I'm happy to be repping the second generation and all the family people in the first two rows here. So this is exciting. So let's do it. This is the tale of five young women who met in the year 1966. Each of them had been on her own psychedelic adventure, and then they found each other in the land of Haight-Ashbury. Mary Gannett had come from New York by way of Monterey, California, and was working at Tracy's all-night donut shop on Haight Street. She found an apartment on nearby Waller Street for $75 a month and furnished it with an upright piano. Marla Hunt took a Greyhound bus from Los Angeles, headed to the Haight, and soon discovered Mary and her piano. Diane Vitalich, born and raised in San Francisco, quit her day job to dance to her own drum. Mary Ellen Simpson moved from the California desert to the big city, spending her time working at a credit agency and listening to Jimmy Reed. The four shared a love of music, and Lady Fortune brought them together. They decided they were an all-girl band, and then on New Year's Eve 1966, Mary Ellen went to a party at the band Blue Cheers house in the Haight. She wandered upstairs into an empty bedroom and was playing the blues on her guitar when another young woman heard the music and walked into the room. She pulled out a harmonica and started jamming with Mary. That was Denise Kaufman. That's how this is going to go. By the way, the Red House is Forest Knowles, Dennis. Check your footnotes. Fairfax is great, but the San Geronimo Valley, baby. Denise, born and raised in San Francisco, quit school at UC Berkeley to get on a bus and become a prankster Mary Microgram. Denise had already played in a few bands and had recorded a single on the Wii Records label. She'd always been the only woman playing in bands with guys, and she didn't know any women who could even play.
So when Mary Ellen asked me to come over and meet her new friends that she was playing with and see this all-girl band, my first thought was, all-girl band? That is crazy. I had never even considered an all-girl band. And then I thought, well, maybe can they really play? So I had to go over and check them out.
Denise met the girls at their apartment on 1480 Waller Street. They asked her to play one of her songs, so she sat on the floor, as you can see she likes to do, and as the sun streamed in and played this song, The Yellow Petaled Flower.
I just want to say that after I heard Denise that day sing this song, both myself and Mary Ellen both just said, she has got to be in the band.
In the living room at Waller Street, Diane set up her snare, her bass drum, her hi-hat, and her one cymbal. Mary Ellen had the guitar her parents had given her. Her friend Bruce lent Mary Gannon a bass and a small amp, and they were good to go. They laughed a lot and wrote their first song, taking the recent pot bust of their friend Loretta at Waller Street and other motley facts of Life on the Hate as lyric inspiration. This is a little taste of that first song, The Waller Street Blues. Take it away. Denise was working at Fantasy Records in the Mission, running the office and doing PR. Max Weiss, the president of Fantasy, let the girls practice there in the studio three nights a week. And at this point, they needed some better musical gear, but couldn't afford to buy it. Of course, they didn't have any credit, not that it would have helped, because women weren't allowed to have credit cards in 1967. So, Max Weiss kindly signed for them to rent some gear at Leo's Music in Oakland.
Ambrose Hollingsworth was a shaman, a mystic, a poet, an esoteric historian, and had been the manager of Quicksilver Messenger Service until he lost the use of his legs in an auto accident. Leslie Scardelli, age 19, had been a passenger in a car accident and had become a quadriplegic. They were roommates at Mount Zion Hospital on Divisadero Street when I met them. And Ambrose and I began writing songs together. I brought a guitar and my new band of girls after I met them, and we sang around the hospital beds of Ambrose and Leslie. Ambrose asked if he could be our manager, and we said yes. One afternoon, he handed us the Ace of Cups tarot card. And he explained that the Suit of Cups was about emotion, love, creativity, music and flow, and that the ace was the highest expression of that energy. We knew we were the Ace of Cups. There's our card. And I want to say that Ambrose's daughter, Shauna, also known as Wayaka, is here, and Ambrose's grandson, who we've never met, Sean, is here. Would you guys stand up, please? We love you. Yes, there you are. All right, sweetheart. Right. And Leslie then gave us two amazing gifts. First, he told us to go to Sherman Clay, the biggest music store in San Francisco, and pick out our dream musical gear. Mary Ellen and I got Fender Twin Reverb amps. Mary Gannon got two dual Fender Showmans. Oh my gosh. And she got a bass. Diane got a set of black and pearl Ludwig drums. Whew. And I got a Gibson Tal Farlow hollow body guitar. And after that, I slept with it regularly. The other gift that Leslie gave us was time together. He told us to quit our day jobs and that he would pay for us to move into a house together and work on our music for a few months. Incredible, right? So we moved to a big house on Autumn Lane in Tam Valley, which is about a mile from where we are right now. And we set up our gear in the living room and we wrote more songs. This is a clip of The Hermit, a song that Ambrose and I wrote. It's part of the medley on our album. The male voice you'll hear on it is David Freiberg of Quicksilver Messenger Service. And if you heard more of the medley, you'd hear Terry Haggerty. Are you here, Terry? I don't know if Terry's here. Terry's played on that track, and so did Norman Mail from the Stop With Camel. Terry's from the Sons of Champlain. I know Norman's here, so thank you for your help on that track, you guys. Terry's here. All right. Terry and Norman, thank you. So here's The Hermit, a little taste of it.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Ambrose and Leslie, operating as Thunder Heaven Productions, produced the Festival of Growing Things, 2 days of music up at the Mount Tam Amphitheater. Ambrose gave everyone who paid to attend a beautiful glass bead and a small packet of seeds. Bands on the bill included Eric Burden and the Animals, the Sons of Champlain, Big Brother and the Holding Company, Strawberry Alarm Clock, Quicksilver Messenger Service, and the Ace of Cups. This was the girls' big hometown gig. Mary Gannon was so excited about the show that it was only just before they were ready to play that she discovered she'd forgotten to bring her bass. Luckily, Al Strong from Sons of Champlain lent her his bass and saved the day. In this clip from the Jack O'Connell film Revolution, you can see Mary on the stage dancing around and playing Al Strong's beautiful Fender bass. Thanks, Al. In May of 67, Michael Bloomfield was putting together his own band, the Electric Flag. Michael asked the Ace if his group could practice for about 6 weeks in their big living room on Autumn Lane. The girls learned a lot about music watching these pros put their band together. The Electric Flag's world debut was at the Monterey Pop Festival, and Michael invited the girls to come as his guests. The Ace had backstage passes, preferred seating, and a motel room on the festival grounds. They saw great performances by Otis Redding and Janis Joplin, but what they remember most is this moment. Mary Ellen, let's hear it.
Yeah, I was over in the motel room, and I through the open window, I heard this sound coming through that I said, we've got to get over there right now. And so, because the motel room was nearby to the venue, and so Mary Gannon and I rushed over, and it was like Jimi Hendrix, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, I was just stunned to hear him play. And I learned a whole new way to play barred chords because he put his thumb over the top of the guitar instead of the way I'd learned. And the other thing was I started taking lessons when I was about 12, and it was folk music. And my guitar teacher always said, you know, when you're done with your playing for the hour or the 2 hours or whatever, always put your guitar away and, you know, take good care of it. So when, at the end of Jimmy's set, when he put his guitar on fire, I thought, oh my God, he's flipped out. They're going to have to come and take him away. I mean, I know that sounds absurd, but I mean now, but I mean, I was young and, you know, I just couldn't believe it.
Three days after Monterey, the Ace of Cups got a call inviting the band to play a free show in the Panhandle on a flatbed truck opening for Jimi Hendrix. They said yes. Jimmy's band needed to use the Ace of Cups amps and drums. Mary Ellen was a little bit nervous about this, and Jimmy picked up on it immediately, and he promised that he would take good care of her new Fender amp and Diane's drums, and they did. He didn't light them on fire. About this time, Ambrose passed the management of the Ace of Cups over to his Chicago buddy, Ron Pulte, who was already managing Quicksilver. Ron Pulte had created West Pole, a visionary office where five band managers worked together to transform the Bay Area music business. Ron loved the Ace of Cups and often quoted their lyrics. Their message of peace and love was a far cry from Ron's tough Chicago roots. Ron's longtime friend and big brother manager, Julius Carpin, also came from Chicago, and he said that, yeah, and he said that even the mafia listened to Ron Pulte. Julius is here.
Julius is here. Julius Carpin, please stand up. And also Sally, Ron's wife, Sally Pulte, Sally Robert. Sally's here. All right. So Julius. So I will tell like this one little story. When Ron first took over our management, he was trying to book gigs for us, and there was a place on Broadway in those days. I don't know how many of you were around San Francisco, but on Broadway in those days, the whole Broadway strip was all topless clubs. Carol Doda, do you remember Carol Doda? Right. So there was one club there called the Peppermint Lounge that did sometimes have rock music, because we had gone there and seen Little Richard play there. And so Ron said, well, maybe I'll try the Peppermint Lounge. And he called up and asked if they would book us. And the manager said, an all-women band? Yes, you know, yeah, we'll book them. And Ron said, well, do you want them to come in on audition? And he said, no, no, they don't need to audition, but they need to play topless. And Ron called and told me that. I said, call him back and tell him we won't play topless, but we'll play naked. They didn't call back.
I was born in front of the fireplace at the Red House in Forest Knolls, where my mother and sister still live to this day, and my brother. Mary Gannon was there at my birth, although I don't remember it myself. And 2 months later, on Valentine's Day 1969, all the Ace of Cups gathered in the cabin behind our house while Mary Gannon was in labor. The wood stove burned gently through the night, and Talina was born at dawn. Mary wrote the song Makushla, telling the story of her love for Joe, and Denise wrote a song to welcome Talina and all the children being born in our extended family. Here's a taste of each of these songs from the album.
So some of the children who sang on that record maybe, or their families may be here tonight. If that's you, please stand up. We had a wonderful little chorus of great kids. Also, some of the children whose names are in that song, I think we have Raisin Kane, and I think we have Tora, and we have Padre, and we may have Chloe here, and Solomon is with us in spirit. And any of the other kids that are here, please, and any of the kids of that generation, would you guys stand up, all the kids of that generation? Come on, stand up. We love you all, right? Yes, everybody. Yes. So little did we think when we wrote that song that all these years later we would be singing about Jasper Starfire in those days, and he would be being our beautiful narrator for our story all this time later. And so thank you so much, Jasper.
Thank you. Yeah. And here I keep keeping us on track, because we want to hear the ladies rock and roll tonight. Am I right? One of the most amazing gigs the Ace of Cups ever played was for Bill Graham at Winterland in April of 69. They opened for the band for their first ever show.
I'll take it from there, because that was an amazing night. The second night at Winterland, we were in the groove. And during my drum solo on Afro Blue, I found myself as if someone else was playing. I was in the zone. And at that time, I never knew what that meant. But my drum teacher, Jerry Ginnelli, used to say, lose yourself in the music and let it play you. So at the end of the song, our road manager, Frank Pulte, Ron Pulte's brother, he said, he described it perfectly. He said, it was so, it was like a wave that started with people standing up from the front row, then the next, until everyone was standing in the full house. We had a standing ovation. A maybe wonderful night.
In the late 60s, the Ace of Cups sang background vocals for the Jefferson Airplane, Quicksilver, Michael Bloomfield, and Chicago bluesman Nick the Greek Gravanitis, a dear friend of the band. And just last week, the Ace were honored to sing and play for Nick's 80th birthday celebration. They sang his song, My Labors, a song they had recorded with him 50 years ago. And here we go with a little taste of that. 50 years ago, a couple weeks ago, and right now.
I'm here and you're there. Or... Okay.
We stay right here. Right here.
Nick Gravanitis.
Just stay here.
By late 1971, times had changed. The band had never been offered a real record deal, and they felt as though the opportunity had passed them by. By now, four of them were young mothers. Mary Ellen moved to the Trinity Alps, Denise and Mary Gannon moved to Kauai, Hawaii, and Diane was playing with Marla in the Fairfax Street Choir. Over the next decades, the women got together when they could to play and sing together. Wherever the winds of life took them and whatever day jobs they were doing to pay the rent, they all kept playing music. Mm-hmm. All right, I'm going to pass the mic back to Dennis with his Justin Timberlake mic and ask Mountain Girl to join the panel on stage and encourage all y'all to buy CDs for your sons and your daughters and an extra copy for your daughters, too. Thanks so much for including me here tonight, you guys.
So... do not despair. You're going to get about 20 more minutes of talk, and then the real deal. But this is going to be interesting talk, I guarantee. We thought that you would like to hear what the Ace's peers thought, both at the time and now, about this fairly amazing story. Starting from my left, your left too, probably, Mr. Wavy Gravy.
Hippie icon, flower geezer, and temple of accumulated error. And on my left...
Mr. Gravy is the clown saint of the counterculture, the founder with Ja of the Hog Farm, Seva. I know Larry Brilliant is out there somewhere. Co-founder of Seva. And coming. And there's a table over there, Camp Wind Rainbow. A circus arts camp that has been going forever. Bonnie Jean Beecher, otherwise known as Jahanara. Ja is the executive director. I don't know, what title did you take for Camp Winter Rainbow? Boss.
Co-founder and now director emeritus.
Oh, isn't that a lovely word to say?
Me too.
Next, Barry the Fish Melton. A co-founder of Country Joe and the Fish, who has also played in more bands than he can possibly remember. He was also the hippest chief public defender Yolo County will ever know.
Got me out of jail.
And finally, Carolyn Adams Garcia, otherwise known as Mountain Girl. So I had to introduce her to somebody I've known a long time, and I just wrote, is a legend. But let me just add that at the tender age of 18, she was hitchhiking in Palo Alto
and her karma arranged for her to be picked up by one Neil Cassidy. And the rest is history. In more ways than one. She became, as a result of that ride, she became part of Ken Kesey and his Merry Pranksters. And they, in turn, she met the members of the Grateful Dead, one of whom she made very fortunate by marrying, Mr. Jerry Garcia. She is the author of The Primo Plant and is currently working on her memoirs, which I might add is one of the books. Few books are more breathlessly awaited.
And there's trouble.
That's not a joke.
I'm waiting for it, too.
I'll bet. So each of you have witnessed the ace. Just to throw this, I'll throw it open, but I'd like to start with MG because Denise, many of you may know, was once nicknamed amongst the pranksters Mary Microgram. Yes, what's a microgram? Well, it's a very small measure of something very, very powerful. I refuse, in this day and age, when actually there seems to be like slight progress in treating LSD-25 as something other than just say no, that it's part of the history of the Ace of Cups and all of us. And maybe you'd like to talk about that.
Well, I think that it's a useful molecule for creativity and music. And it certainly worked for everybody I knew at the time. And LSD was part and parcel of the whole Grateful Dead development of their whole musical genre. And just about everybody else had to experience it one way or another. And if you weren't willing, they found other ways to to help you along the way. So it really was like neurogenesis for the music and culture movement of the 60s. It was pretty much fueled by some very nice LSD made by friends of ours, who shall remain unnamed, but you've all heard of them already, so what?
Bear with her.
Yeah, and so anyway, so Denise jumped on the bus, and I don't remember exactly where, but the bus was rotating somewhere through California, and she appeared with her harmonica and her amazing skill and charmed everybody and was immediately given a wonderful prankster name of Mary Microgram, which I'm not sure she really liked it at first, but it worked okay. And the bus was on its way to Los Angeles at that point. And we took our acid test to L.A., and where we immediately encountered Hugh Romney at this funny little club, the Midnight Cafe. What was it?
Phantom Cabaret.
Thank you so much.
Me and Tiny Tim and Moondog, yep. Which was later replaced by Del Close and the great Severin Darden. Severin Xavier Tekel Darden III, actually.
And we realized we had met masters and geniuses far beyond our understanding. And we all sort of fell to our knees and laughed ourselves silly at these guys. And we blended, we melded, we got together and went on to really create some amazing scenes and indoctrinate a lot of people.
Rented this giant warehouse in Watts. The place was still smoldering from the Watts riots. And I remember getting on a microphone and saying, now pay attention. The Kool-Aid on the right is the electric Kool-Aid. The Kool-Aid on the left is for the children. Once again, and I went over it like 15 times, but people would come out after dancing to the Grateful Dead for 3 hours, and they'd just grab something wet, and something wet was very, very powerful.
It was indeed. It was really powerful. It was a little too powerful that night, and a lot of people had a bit of a meltdown, but
who cares? You know,
Wavy Gravy actually dealt with whoever was having a bit of a rough transition. And as the night wore on and the cops would come by and look in the door and shrug and walk away again, figuring we were just drunk out of our minds, and that's just what people do when they've really gone over the edge. until dawn. We went all the way till dawn. And some of us walked up to the watchtowers and looked at the towers at dawn as, a couple of us poured out, as the cops were watching, we poured out the big trash cans full of Kool-Aid into the storm sewer. And right about that time, they're going like, hey, wait a minute, and decided to promptly arrest a few of us for public drunkenness.
Paul Foster was drunk. Yeah, they said he was drunk. We had just cut off his electrical tape shoes with scissors and were ringing bells over his feet.
You know, we were so, like
a vision just now. Oh.
But we were so silly. You know, we gave ourselves and everybody else permission to be as silly as they wanted to be. And that really seemed to be the thing that sort of cracked open the nut of rigid conservatism that was infesting California at the time.
Silly Rama.
Go ahead. Well, you know, I was also wanted to ask Ja about something that I've been thinking about related to this, because it was sort of, for us as women, becoming empowered in a whole new way at that time. You may want to say something about that, too. Yes, I could. But in the Wavy Gravy movie, which if you haven't seen it, you want to, made by Michelle Ezrich, which tells the story of Wavy and Ja's life. There's one moment when you're in the... in the film at Woodstock, are you talking about Woodstock? Well, first they show you at Woodstock, but then talks about how you felt creating the free kitchen at Woodstock to feed that 400,000 people. Would you say that again?
Sure. I'm the past director of a performing arts camp, but I don't go up on stage. So I'll answer your question, Denise, by I was just at the Watts acid test in my mind, and I was a nice young lady.
Very beautiful.
And I stood at the door, and as I recall, I think the next day was the day that LSD was to be made illegal. But it was
right
before midnight. And so we were still, we knew that we could get away with a bit. And so I stood at the door, and I was the police greeter. And I invited them in, and I offered to be their tour guide. And in a polite and friendly way, I would bring them around to what was happening, and I would announce what it was as though I was talking about, and here's Act One, here's the people painting Diglo colors on the mannequins, and over here we're getting revved up for the music. I was a nice... helping young person, a dosed a bit, yes, but I could act real normal, and so I was a police commissioner, and the thing that Denise is referring to was when we went to Woodstock, we were the help people, the hog farm, the community in which I still live. And we were set up to bring along and prepare food for the few people who would be coming that didn't have their own, picnic supplies with them. And so we were prepared to have a kitchen that would serve breakfast and dinner to probably 5,000 or 6,000 people. And...
But I got on a microphone and I said, good morning. What we have in mind is breakfast in bed for 400,000. Which was granola that they had made up. And we brought it to them in Dixie cups. They were enmeshed in mud. And we kept handing, what is this shit, gravel? No, it's granola. Eat it. And they liked it. And the granola manufacturers of the world owe us an enormous debt.
And when we arrived and people, you know, as you all know the story, there was tens of hundreds of thousands of people surrounding us, many, many of whom had not brought rations with them. And so I begin to know, you know, just like one does in life, you notice that someone's hungry over there and you figure out how to make it so that we're serving 40 people a minute rather than 2 people 10 minutes. And you notice the water is not running on the pipes, and we find someone who can put that together. And after a while, we were, those of us who were experienced in living together, which all of us hippies were, and how to make things work, we were found ourselves just wheeling around and organizing. And I was holding meetings with the doctors that had helicoptered in to work with the people who were the hippies who were used to dealing with people who had partaken unfamiliar drugs.
Abby Hoffman actually organized the hospital tent, separating the nurses from the doctors, etc. And that was an amazing... amazing piece of organizing.
Well, they triaged. But the after a while, the hippies who were familiar with this kind of scene were being asked, you know, we were working together with the doctors who could tell that we actually knew what we were doing in this terrain. And what happened to me, which has never left me, is that I realized that we were alone. There was no one in charge. We were the ones who were making it happen, who were making, and that we did a really good job. Really good job.
Denise and I missed Woodstock, and we got to watch it on TV. Because there was a scene. It was just the wildest thing ever. We go, gee, I hope. And the band, the Grateful Dead, went, and I was worried about them the whole time. Would they ever be able to escape? Would they lose all their equipment? Would they get lost in the crowd? We didn't know, because there was no communication in and out. It was wild and unexpected and completely unusual.
Jerry,
they got out. I rode on the plane with them back to San Francisco. They lived. Amazingly, because one of the guys, not a member of the band, of course, managed to have a small bottle of murine that he put on all the eggs in the employees' cafeteria at the JFK Airport in New York. And I was worried for days. I would look in the paper to see if there was news of a plane crash. There wasn't.
I had never heard that story before.
See,
thank you, Barry.
Something new every night. I'd like to touch on one subject from two people. One is from Barry, to talk about being a peer, that is to say a fellow musician, of the Ace, and what you thought when you saw them, including MG, to answer the real, the sort of the odd question, the elephant in the room, which is, so why no record deal?
Well, I want to say that we're near the epicenter of rock and roll in the Bay Area in many respects, because right down the road, if you go left out of the community center here, you'll end up at the Marin Heliport, where the Ace of Cups worked and the Sons of Champlin worked and Quicksilver worked and the Grateful Dead and, so many of the, and I worked there. I mean, it was the Heliport was a breeding grounds of Bay Area music.
Because you could be noisy there. It was okay.
Yeah. And you hung out with people. I think I spent more time smoking joints and sort of sitting in front of the Heliport talking to people than I ever spent rehearsing. But they were, don't take this the wrong way, but they were one of the guys, I mean, they really were. I mean, they were us. We were them. They were real, and they were real good, and they still are. And
yes, they are. But at the same time, they were fighting an uphill battle with the record companies, and this is one of the reasons there was no record, was because they were girls. And in those days, girls, not only did they not have credit cards, but they didn't really get the credit they deserved for the fantastic job they did creating wonderful music. And somehow the record company executives just kind of like passed over them, you know, like, we want to see the guys. We want to see the guys with long hair burning their guitars. That was where maybe they thought that the energy and the money should go. And really, quality didn't seem to matter too much to the record companies. What they wanted was excitement and male energy. And they missed such a huge... What they missed something so fabulous, this amazing pearl, you know, before the swine, really. And, and the swine got the money and the record deals, and the girls had to wait really a long time to get the recognition, and I'm really happy that you got it, and you sure showed it tonight here on stage. What a wonderful, beautiful performance.
Oh, it's convenient that you're here, because I was just thinking, you know, was there anybody other than Wavy that could have gotten you guys to reunite for that 75th party?
I can't think of anybody.
Yeah.
The rest of them are already, like, off the earth already.
Yeah.
Pulte could have, Ambrose could have, you know. But, no, there would be nobody that could draw us from everywhere like you.
Well, Wavy was always really good at doing the ask. And he was fearless about doing the ask. When everybody else would sort of quiver and wonder about the consequences, he just forged ahead.
And also Tamara was, you know, it was just nice. Tamara said, we'd really love to have you. We'd love to have some women on the bill. And we're like, yeah, that sounds great. We'll pull that together. So, yeah. I don't know if you're here, Tamara, but thank you.
Aren't the Ace of Cups going to get up here and sing for heaven's sake?
In about five minutes. We're galloping. We're galloping towards that point.
Are you going to play it?
Yeah.
Oh, George got me into a studio with the Ace of Cups, and somehow technology mastered me. I actually got to sing on key for the first time in my life. And they're going to throw it up on the big screen with the girls. Yes.
Yay.
Clown to tower, clown to tower.